Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week, our attention turns to the global post-COVID rebuild as investment professionals the world over mull the opportunities and pitfalls of the various sectors in the market on the search for reliable growth. Locally, the Australian stock market has been largely flat over the last few months as the positivity of better than average pandemic performance is tainted by the withdrawals of stimulus like JobKeeper and the business cash flow boost. Limited international immigration and the prospect of no new international students until 2022 further hampering the outlook in the short term. So with tempered expectations for local growth, the wizened investor is now looking overseas where the combination of continued pandemic pain and associated stimulus presents opportunity for those able to put in the work and position their portfolio for success. With Europe, France in particular, still grappling with the virus, there lies some opportunity for more fearless investors seeking value with a number of caveats. In the US, things are looking a lot brighter. With a new era of Bidenomics heralding over $2 trillion of new stimulus for key infrastructure areas, non-defence, R&D and manufacturing, a healthy vaccination rate that has surpassed expectations, but in turn, they're still not completely out of the woods yet. With traditional defensive stocks not currently behaving defensively, the new challenge lies in optimising global coverage that positions for growth whilst ensuring some downside protection is maintained. Joining us today to cover off on where we've been positioning for success in the post-pandemic world, we have Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Good to have you on. A little bit of a quieter show this time. We haven't got the blockbuster guests and whatnot, and David's away today, unfortunately, but we'll carry on with a terrific topic for today. A quick reminder, of course, too, that before we get started, if you haven't already, subscribe and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, and follow us on your preferred podcast platform. We also ask if you'd like to take a moment to click like on the video now to help our show grow. And for those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the YouTube live stream chat to have them answered along the way. So let's jump into it. So we'll get into our... agenda for today. So we're going to kick off with the global equities boom. Sounds exciting. We're going to roll around to the Australian dollar. We'll have a look at the fiscal guns, which are loaded. Parlay that into central banks, of course, on the other side of the monetary spectrum. And then finish off, as we do every day here, looking at how we can use these themes in our portfolios, both in the past, but also, of course, in the future at Nucleus Wealth. So with no further ado, let's jump into it. There's been a global equities boom, Damien.
Yeah, so I wanted to this week focus a bit more on what's been happening in markets, and so probably a little bit more market focused than our, like, I think we usually take a bit of a longer term view on some of these. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to talk about some of the shorter term movements in the markets and how that's sort of playing into how we're looking at portfolios over the longer term.
Sure.
And we're seeing, because I think even though so this month we've seen a big boom in terms of growth in terms of markets for particularly for international markets in Australia, international markets from an Australian investor's perspective.
Yep.
But it's also worth sort of keeping in mind that there's actually been a lot more movement underneath. So the headline, you sort of look at the headline level and see what's going on, and within the sectors though, there's actually been some quite stark changes within what you're seeing. And I think there's a bit of a turning point. We're reaching a bit of a turning point for some of those sectors. So,
yep.
We've spoken a few times about this being the amphetamines cycle. Everything's condensed and sped up,
yep.
So I think that's sort of leading back to where we are now as well, and saying, well, it's not a typical cycle where you can sort of go, yeah, let's place the bets, wait 6 or 12 months, then start moving on to your next bets and stuff like that. It seems to be that placing bets, they're coming good really quickly, and then it's like a question of
pivot.
Okay, what's next?
Yeah, sure.
So I wanted to sort of run through a bit of that.
Okay,
I've got up on screen a relatively stark difference in terms of performance. So I'll focus on the far right hand side. So the MSCI World sort of popped about 4-odd%, almost 5%, I think, over the last month.
Huge month.
Yeah, whereas the Australian, so you can see the Australian market didn't move as much.
Mm.
The the Australian market's well above international over the last year. So if you go back to basically pretty close to the lows, I guess, from the 1st of March 2020, the Aussie market's considerably outperformed international. But that's in Aussie dollar terms. If you flip to US dollar terms, you can see that the MSCI World actually thumped the Australian market. And so it's mainly been currency that's sort of been driving that, the disparate return.
Yep. Okay.
So I guess I just wanted to really highlight that because there's some fundamental factors which we think are driving international markets more than Australian markets. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the positives for the Australian economy in particular have started to turn at the moment.
Yep.
And so we're sort of saying it's time now to start looking to get back into your international.
Yep.
As a big holding. So, you know, I think over the last 6 to 12 months, well, certainly the last 6 months, we've had a bigger holding in terms of Aussie stocks relative to international.
Okay.
And now we've flipped that back around and taking a much larger holding in international stocks relative to Australia.
And of course, there's that currency piece, but we'll cover off on that a little bit later.
Yeah. So I guess, though, it's, I mean, the fundamentals, which we'll deal with in a second, but the fundamentals are one part, and the fundamentals have looked better overseas, I guess is what I'm saying, for a lot of the international companies, regardless of the fact that the Australian economy has done quite well
through the pandemic
in terms of controlling the virus, but actually the earnings haven't kept up, and even the prices haven't kept up, but that's been hidden by the change in the Aussie dollar.
Okay.
And so unless you're considering the Australian dollar, so if you've got a view that the Australian dollar is going to keep booming and it's going to go, you know, we're headed back to say parity with the US dollar, then there's a good reason to keep holding on to Aussie shares.
Absolutely.
If you think that things are starting to peak out, we've spoken about commodity prices in the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. We've spoken about inflation. We've spoken about central banks and governments and those types of factors. Then we'll come up with our conclusion, which is sort of heading back the other way.
Sure.
The other thing I wanted to highlight on the left there, I've got a few of the sectors, just the biggest performers. And so energy sort of leading the pack there. So that's been coming off its lows. It's a tricky one, the energy sector. The big issue there is you've got OPEC holding off massive amounts of inventory off the market in order to keep prices high.
Okay.
And so the question is, if and when the demand comes back, will they keep holding that off and so the prices keep running up, or will they start leaking it back on? And when they do start leaking it back on, are they going to bring it back on fast so to try and cap prices out at where they are now and try and pick up as much volume as possible? Mm-hmm. Or are they going to hold off and just sort of gradually drip it back on?
Is a factor of that, the sort of fiscal status of the OPEC countries, so they decide that they need some oil revenue. A lot of them are very oil revenue sort of focused, so they go, okay, we'll flood supply for a bit, clean up on the high oil prices, and shore up our fiscal balance sheets potentially.
Maybe it's hard to tell what's motivating. I think that, I think the biggest factor over the medium term that should be that is affecting them is US shale.
Okay.
So it's the idea that US shale is actually very reactive. It can come on a lot faster than traditional new wells.
So that prevents them from doing exactly that, perhaps a little bit.
Well, the issue for them is if they hold off too much. If the prices are, if, say, oil prices are $80, and they're holding off supply, then the US shale guys are just going to swamp the market,
right,
and drive the prices back down. And so they'll be sort of sitting there getting these nice high prices, but then the prices will disappear, and they actually didn't get the volumes out because they're holding it all off.
Yep. Okay.
And so they sort of want to try and get they want to keep the prices as high as possible, but not so high that you don't get a shale.
Encourages
boom.
The external competitors.
And at current levels, you're starting to get the shale really starting to pick up. Mm-hmm. And so it's now a game of poker. So I'm tend not to take too much of a bet on either way at the moment at these prices. I sort of feel as if oil price gets much higher, then we'll certainly be it's sort of $70-$80. We'd be absolutely underweight.
Yep.
And at $30-$40, we're buying
back
it
in again,
and we're in sort of 50s and 60s. We're just a little bit agnostic and sort of saying it's the risks. There's considerable risks in either direction. Mm. So, and we think there's easier money to be made in some of these other sectors.
And that's a good point. So I guess, obviously, there's we sort of touched on, I guess, the point of today's show is really talking around the positioning, and sector positioning is a huge part of a portfolio construction method, I guess, and particularly when you're looking at diversification. And some other sectors of note.
Yeah, so some of the other ones that have been running up, obviously financials is another big one. That's been one, and actually I'll move a little bit more into that in a minute. Again, this is I guess this is more of an issue of saying, where do you think the long term and the short term are going in terms of financials? Mm-hmm. Actually, let's jump to the next slide, because I'll show you this is just our international portfolio, which had a particularly good month over 6%.
Certainly has. It's amazing.
Versus the benchmark, a bit under 5. But I just wanted to highlight what I've got up here is just sort of where we've been. What's been driving that? Mm-hmm. So part of it's been a big underweight to information technology, just in terms of the there's some very expensive stocks within that sector. There's a number of ones. We actually think some of the bigger, more well-known names, the Microsofts and Googles, and actually, sorry, Google's not in that sector, but Microsofts and some of the semis. There are pockets of the semiconductor space, like, say, Intel,
yep.
That have actually been relatively fairly priced.
Mm-hmm.
And have sort of decent growth prospects. There's a whole chunk of stocks within the information technology sector that just got too expensive, though, and were really just bid up there on even though they've got these great underlying fundamentals and great growth, the prices were just way too high.
Okay.
And so we've seen that really come back over the last month. So that's been a big factor. So we are starting to pick up more information technology stocks. Some of those ones that have come back, we're starting to dabble in those.
Mm-hmm.
By and large, that sector there's still some certain overpricing within that sector.
Okay. Yep.
The materials sector is a more interesting one, which is the other place that's sort of really been driving what we've got.
So just an example for those listening in on materials?
Well, materials can be your commodity prices, yep. and things like that, but for us it's not. For us it's been cement stocks, and that's been one of our biggest holdings within that,
mm-hmm.
and a lot more focus. That's been one that sort of, for a little bit there, was sort of a bit of a drag on the portfolio a few months ago, but really has come good over the last month or 2 months as more of the focus has come back to the stimulus packages that are coming through and Biden's plans in particular for expansion.
Yep.
And so
significant expansion as well.
Significant.
2 trillion plus, yeah. 2.25, I think it was.
Yeah, that's right. And so, yeah, spending hundreds of billions of dollars on roads and bridges and all those types of things, which is where the cement sort of comes through.
Absolutely.
Into those. And I think that's the cement sector as well was another sector which is we still think there's a little bit left in it, but it was one of those sectors where that sort of fits very much the value call, and that's been this whole value versus growth argument that's been on.
Yep.
So a few months ago, it was all about getting growth, finding the Nvidias and Teslas and all these stocks that are just on huge multiples, but saying, oh, interest rates are low, and so therefore, I have no alternative, and so I'm keep reducing my discount rate, and these things are keep getting worth more and more.
Yep.
As interest rates have risen, now people's valuations have come back on that. These value sectors of just basic things that make money and are priced on sort of price to earnings ratios rather than sort of 50 to 100 times you might have seen in that infotech sector are priced on single digit sort of 8 or 9 times.
Wow. Yep.
PEs. They've started to come into vogue, and people are saying, well, maybe I'll just take the safe bet. Yeah, exactly. and you've got the other factors of rising behind that, which is the infrastructure spend globally, not just we are seeing more and more fiscal spend from governments right around the world. So it's certainly led by the US,
mm-hmm.
but not just the US. And we're expecting as well that success in the US will also see more of that start to
follow through into Europe and the other major markets.
Monkey see, monkey do, yep. type stuff.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, absolutely.
So, so that's sort of been the biggest ones for the month. But, as I've sort of, I guess the message I've been, as I'm talking about these, is that just because they've been a good performer doesn't mean it's going to be a good performer again next month. And so and that's where the danger, that's where we're certainly...
It's where the inactive management comes in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And so there's some of the sectors. Actually, we'll flick on to the next. I've got a list of the sort of some of the key themes that I wanted to sort of run through in this.
Absolutely.
Oh, sorry. Actually, first, before I do that, I just want to show... earnings per share still booming. These are forecasts. So the blue line is the 12-month forward forecasts. The red lines are the individual years. And so basically what it is each every month you sort of get a little bit more of 2022 and a little bit less of 2021, and you keep rolling it forward. The real key to this is that usually what you see is analysts are too aggressive on their forecasts and you just see gradual downgrades as they go forward. That hasn't been the case, and in particular for 2021, by now you'd be expecting to starting to see the downgrades, because it's always that, you know, in the middle of 2000, when you're looking like a year or 18 months out, analysts are always like, oh, things are going to be fantastic, you know, in 18 months' time.
Yep.
I'm going to grow at, you know, 10% per annum. And then as you get closer, they're like, oh, okay, maybe it's not going to be 10, maybe it's only going to be 8. And then you get a bit closer, and then it's like, oh, 5, you know, 4 okay. or 5. And eventually you get back to the real number.
Yep. Haven't seen that in this one.
This one, you're going the other way.
Yeah, they're right.
Sort of going,
it's getting bigger.
Getting bigger. Yeah, that's right. And I think a lot of that's been stuff we've been discussing is that the idea that just the general thing that companies had this huge shock to, oh my God, we're headed into a global pandemic. We really have to go through and cut costs. Everyone went through and cut costs, then found out things weren't as bad as what they're expecting.
Yep.
And so what they're finding is that as the sales revenue is coming back, the profits are actually growing a lot faster than before. And so you can see on this one, this is the US S&P, which is sort of a decent global guide. It's, mm-hmm. it's mainly international companies. And you can see that the growth rates, the earnings per share is now higher than what it was pre-pandemic.
Prior. Yeah, that's
so
amazing.
So this is forecast, 12-month forecast.
Yeah, sure.
So, so certainly a positive signs continue in terms of that, and we just keep seeing those upgrades. There's not a lot to that. And I think the other thing is it's worth noting now that I think by and large companies are on top of the whole lockdown side as well. Is what we're finding is that when you first saw the lockdowns, initial lockdowns a year ago, companies were cutting things and losing some revenue and they weren't prepared, you know, business disruptions. Now that we're seeing, say, lockdowns throughout France and yes, there's certainly disruptions on a number of retailers in particular and tourism and other factors. But I guess the broader companies now have worked out what they're doing in terms of, okay, we're running a factory. If a lockdown happens, here's what we're doing. It doesn't necessarily mean that we go from 100 to zero.
Yep.
Maybe we go to from 100 to 60 or 70 or 80. And so we managed to keep something still going.
Take the shock out of it as well. We've got a procedure in place.
And exactly.
Yeah, smooth the whole thing over.
And so the earnings aren't being hit anywhere nearly as badly as what you saw before.
So does this mean future pandemics? Fingers crossed we don't see too many, but a little bit of insulation, I guess, given that.
Absolutely. If you see pandemics in the next 4 or 5 years, then people are prepared for it.
Yep.
You see it in 20 years' time, people will have forgotten
and
you'll be back to start again. So,
fair enough.
You know, I think there's a little bit of
protection, but it'll ebb away over time.
So. Yeah, but I think certainly people are learning to live with willing to live with it.
Cool.
So, okay, so that's earnings per share. Jumping into the things I want to talk. So some of the ones. So travel stocks was one we sort of loaded up on, and to be honest, it hurt us end of last year.
Mm-hmm.
Is
that a case of going too early or?
Yeah, we're just a little bit too early on that call. But they've come good, very, very good since then. So I think, and more than made up for any losses that sort of came through. So that's one where we still think there is some positive growth sort of to come.
Yep.
It
stands to reason because travel's not back really yet, is it?
Not at all.
Yeah.
No. But you are seeing signs within the US and certainly in terms of survey signs, as people are getting vaccinated and starting to get back to normal, the first things they're doing is starting to look to eat out and looking to travel again.
Yep.
And so, we still haven't got international travel sort of up and running, but I think that's coming not too distant future. I think what we'll start seeing is countries that have hit significant vaccination hurdles, US in particular and UK, you'll start to see, okay,
the bubbles
start opening up. And, and it's more just in terms of saying, well, in terms of, the US, at a certain vaccination rate, it'll just be about saying, well, it actually doesn't even matter now that Europe, say, is lagging on the vaccinations. The US is all right. So if people come from Europe come over with the disease, then the US, it's not going to harm the US.
It's all sorted.
The
US got your health and seniors and everything else and at-risk people all organised. And
yeah. And
fair majority of them.
It's not a matter of saying, and I'll also repeat the same thing I've been saying before in a lot of these, is it's not a matter of actually saying every single person needs to be vaccinated before these things are going to open up.
Yep.
But based on the way the US is going, they'll be at the stage where we say every single US person has had the opportunity, or they've been given, you know, whatever it is, a couple of weeks window to say book yourself in and get it.
Yep.
So if people who haven't had it and then get it, it's back to personal responsibility.
It's on them.
Yeah, exactly. And the main factor, you know, we've been going on since the start of this, is about the hospital system.
Yep.
You can't let your hospital system go overrun.
Mm-hmm.
People die from things, whether it's the flu, car accidents, all various diseases around the world. It happens.
Yep.
And as a society, we've built our society around accepting the fact that there are going to be deaths in particular sectors, and as long as it's not swamping our hospital systems, because we didn't want people dying from car accidents or dying from asthma attacks or something like that, because they couldn't get a bed and a ventilator because they were being used. But once your vaccination hits a certain point, and US is getting close, we think, you know, Israel's probably there in terms of it, then it takes the pressure off your hospital system and really just sort of opens you up to getting back to life as usual.
Okay.
So travel stops coming good.
Banks.
For us, it's been about, I guess if we were braver, we might have gone more overweight. For us, we don't have a longer-term positive view on the banks, but with rising this inflation scare coming and rising bond rates, it was pretty clear banks were going to perform well. So for us, it was about saying, well, we need at least a market weight or close to market weight so that we're not getting left behind in that.
So actually, just a question on that. So obviously the central bank rate hasn't changed materially, but the bond rates have completely, yields have completely exploded, meaning that there's been a sell-off in bonds. So
at the long end.
At the long end,
not
yeah.
at the short end. So basically,
So how does that help banks?
So banks are very much, they borrow at the short-term rates and from people who are putting deposits with them, and then lend out at longer term rates.
Okay.
And so the higher the longer term rate, the better they do. The
better it works for them. Okay.
So that's good at the moment. We do think that's going to turn at some stage. It's probably got a little bit further to run. We think there's going to be some pretty big inflation prints you're going to see, and market's going to get a bit excited about the whole inflation stuff, especially with all the news coming out of the US.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a little bit more to come from that, but I guess we're looking for signs that we're going to get back to where we used to be, which is the idea that we don't think the inflation has been completely solved.
Yep.
And so there'll be a time to start loading back and going underweight banks again.
Yep. So there's an opportunity in the short term if you feel that the inflation's not going to fully pan out.
Yeah. Now there is a potential that there'll be more stuff. Biden's will come out with more stuff, and other governments around the world will start coming out with more, and you will actually be able to get inflation going.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the part where, if banks, we're trying to avoid losing on this bet rather than trying to make a big win out of it.
Okay.
Because we think the odds are stacked the other direction.
Other way. Yep.
But short term, you just want to hold on to that, and it's a bit similar to your whole market position, is saying, look, if the whole market's moving up on the basis that maybe everything will be fixed, even if the odds are against it being fixed, there's
You've
a small chance.
A
yeah, because yeah. otherwise you might be stuck in this position where you just never get a chance to buy in. You're sort of sitting there going, okay, I'm making a bet that the whole thing's going to come unravelled, and then markets assume that it won't come unravelled, and you're sort of sitting there waiting, and if things do finally come good, you'll be back going, okay, I've just missed out on a 50% rise and
in that
never
sector.
Never had a chance to buy back in.
Fair enough.
So is that
and when you say banks as well, I guess the work there is in determining the right sort of banks to get into, and going back to those sort of quality element that we focus on here as well, isn't it? So if you want to own a sector, you don't have to own the whole sector. Is that the approach, or are you sort of saying, okay, I'm going to pick
the best
of a bad bunch? And
you're going to get the best returns, and you've seen it over the last little while. You get the best returns from the worst stocks.
Yeah.
So basically, because the stocks are priced to say, okay, this is, there's trouble out there. This company's going to go bust, and you've got a very flat curve, and so profits can be very low, and so the worst bang stops got hit the worst, hit the most, and the best ones sort of held up the best. Now you go into the situation about going, okay, there aren't going to be as many bankruptcies as what you thought, and yield curves are starting to flatten. The ones that did the worst end up
they've been oversold, so they got a bit of value in the trade.
Okay. So the issue though is that's the highest risk part, and so it's very similar in the mining sector as well. Exactly the same, where the worst stocks of the mining sector, the ones that have the highest cost. So let's say, they were producing iron ore at $70, and the iron ore price was at $50, so they're losing $20 a ton. Whereas BHP or a Rio, who's sort of producing and probably at $30 or $40 and making $20, so they're making $20. These guys are losing $20. Now the price goes from $50 to $150.
Yep. Those guys got the biggest delta.
Yeah, that's right. They've gone from losing lots to all of a sudden making lots, and so seen the most upside.
Yeah.
And so. So you get the highest return, but the flip side is your highest risk. And so if things go wrong, they're the ones you're going to see falling the most as well.
Yeah,
so for us, the way we structure our portfolios is very much around safety and about downside protection. And you know, we want to try and hang with the market on the way up and protect on the way down.
Yep.
And so for us, it's about saying, well, if we're concerned about the banks, we don't want to then take the highest risk.
Yeah, of course.
In there.
Yep.
There are other people who are happy to ride the ups and the downs and take those big risks.
Yep. All right. Fair enough.
So the expensive IT. I spoke about the information technology sector coming back, and it's very much, I think I mentioned, it's those expensive ones where you've seen the most effect on that. Also going to talk about in this one as well. So what we've seen is the profitable ones and some of the more value ones within it, they've actually done quite well over the last little while. So IT has been a story of two halves. The more boring companies, say a Cisco or an Intel or something like that, has done quite well. The really exciting growth ones, your NVIDIAs and your Teslas, are
got
the
a bit
ones
frothy and done the pullback. That's fascinating. Okay.
Defensive stocks now. Traditionally, if you're going to buy a defensive stock, what you do is you go out and look at utilities or REITs, so real estate trusts, oil pipelines, these steady income where you just get your yield and you really don't change much.
Big fixed asset sort of style investment.
So investors tend to trade those off against bonds, like that's sort of the next stage up from bonds.
Okay.
And so as we've seen bond yields rising, they've actually been hit because they sort of fall into that same bucket of...
if I can get the same on a bond, why am I taking the equity risk? Sort of,
exactly. And so in terms of defensiveness, and there's other problems within those sectors as well. So your real estate trusts is... You've got this whole thing as, will people come back to cities and will people come back to CBDs?
Absolutely. Commercial real estate trusts in particular.
are seeing massive amounts of vacancies and just the roll-offs in terms of, every day there's a news about, I think yesterday was JP Morgan and somebody else is just trying to sublease these massive amounts of properties that they have in the US with the view that, they generally would take out 10, 15-year leases on a lot of these bigger properties. And they're sitting there going, okay, we're not going to fill these, and we're now moving people to working from home 2-3 days a week, and so therefore we need 40% less property.
Yep.
And so
got to try and figure out
what can we do with it.
Got to get let.
And there's a lot of that that's just not out there. And if you look at sort of mobility stats, even in places like WA in terms of Perth, as Perth CBD, which has probably been one of the least affected by coronavirus of anywhere.
But still loves a boom bust cycle, the old Perth.
Absolutely loves a boom bust cycle. But look at mobility stats and they're still quite down a fair bit within the CBD relative to prior to the pandemic. And so work from home very much looks like it's here to stay. And so your defensive stocks, you need to be sort of quite a bit more discerning about what you want to pick up within that sector. We've actually tended to look for defensiveness in other sectors, whether it's some of your consumer staples, so the people like, say, Unilevers or things like that are actually outselling your toothpastes and your shampoos and
toilet paper.
Toilet paper, yep. Exactly.
Got to use just as much at work as you do at home. So.
Yeah, that's right.
Just circling back to the defensive stock. So you mentioned utilities. I'd be interested just to hear your thoughts on. So as I'm not sure if it falls under the not defensive defensive list, but it does sort of feel like. It shouldn't have been too impacted, but at the same time, maybe it is. So, yeah, what have you seen there?
Look, they've certainly been impacted in terms of prices, okay. And that's been as a trade-off versus bonds. Mm-hmm. So you've very much seen that. Look, if you see bonds go the other way, I think utility sector will hold up.
Yep.
Certainly better than the REIT sector.
Okay. Is there sort of a dip in the manufacturing and sort of maybe... industrial, energy usage, perhaps, for example, that maybe created the issues there, or
look, not particularly.
Okay.
I think there's been there were certainly some blips in terms of where you're doing it, but I think it's certainly been a steady comeback for most of these. I think they also did some cost cutting where they could. Interest rate, most of them are quite highly geared,
and
their own interest rates have come down considerably.
Yep.
And so, so profitability wise, they're not that bad.
Mm-hmm.
There's some which we some of the ones which we have held onto is ones like Transurban, where we think the even though traffic volumes haven't been great so far. The actual relative traffic volumes between cars versus public transport has flipped very much towards cars.
It has.
And
yes.
So...
I've seen it on the freeways out the front of my train station. It's the traffic is back. It is back in Melbourne, Western Melbourne.
Yeah. And in most states. That's one area where we're going. Where I guess it's more specific, but we do think there's some value within that.
Okay, sure.
And then the last bit is the cyclicals, trying to get exposure, as much exposure to the right areas of this cyclicals. And these are the ones, as economies start picking up again, where we think we'll get some growth from. So where we've really chosen is sort of cement and employment services has been our main one.
Yep.
There are other areas. Media is quite often one of these places where you pick up these. That part we're not as positive on. We've sort of tended to stick more with, I suppose, the Google, Facebooks to get that exposure because we think there's this continual shift from traditional medias to online.
Absolutely.
And so although, within media stocks themselves, you have seen some significant rises within it. Again, we're not a fan of the risk-return equation within that, and so we'd prefer to stick with the ones where knowing how much market share is going to be stolen by the online guys just year by year by year by year there's some short-term trade within that media sector, but we're sort of happier to stick on the longer-term outlook. Autos is one area which we've got a little bit of exposure to within cyclicals.
Autos is in automotive manufacturing, car companies,
but they've got their own. They've got lots of their own issues within that whole sector in terms of. So basically, what happened was the pandemic hit. They went and cancelled a whole bunch of their orders for semiconductors. At the same time, what you saw was all these other sectors. Everyone needed a new laptop from home. Everyone needed, all these extra things. Whether it's an electric, a bike. Exercise bike, which has got semiconductors to run your things on it, or
webcams.
Webcams. Exactly.
Couldn't buy a webcam for love nor money.
And so what's happened is car makers have cancelled all these orders. All these other sectors have increased their orders.
Filled up the pipeline.
The car makers have gone, oh, actually, we actually really did need that spot. And the semiconductors have gone, well, we've already converted your line across to making whatever it was. Yeah. Push bikes for stationary bikes or whatever it is.
Yep.
And so it's starting to come back, but it's that issue of, there's a $100,000 BMW that's been made and it hasn't got a computer chip to run the electric seats and
can't sell
the car.
Yeah,
everything else is done. Yep. It's like you can't sell a car because the seats won't go back and forth. And so there are some sort of short-term supply disruptions within that sector.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are issues with trying to find the right stocks within that sector there that are not so affected and not so geared up.
Yep.
We've been playing more in the peripherals.
Yeah.
And some are trying to find some
supplies,
of the other
suppliers. Sort of, what are they called? The supply chains.
The supply. Yeah. Exactly. And so within the second-hand side. So for a while they were playing on the some of the used car sites in, yep. in the UK in particular.
Yeah, right.
Where you know there was good trade there. We've actually flipped out of some of those and looking more at some of the automotive retailers that still look relatively cheap and you know a decent return in terms of the amount of secondhand cars sold is actually and the need for parts because the new cars can't get
the
bigger demand for secondhand cars and more people driving their second cars more without
and obviously need to service them more if things going wrong. Yeah, right. Fantastic. Mm.
So there's certainly elements within those and it's really about trying to find the stocks, the sectors that haven't really run.
Mm.
And you know, there's some great examples. We were looking at logistics stocks during the week and we sort of try and have a deep dive into one or two sectors every week and it's just interesting. You look through, you know, a lot of logistics stocks which are tend to trade at, you know, price to earnings ratios of about 10 times, so relatively cheap. So it's about maybe a 50% discount to the market, maybe 100% discount to the market at certain stages of the cycle. Just because a lot of these are pretty boring stocks.
Yeah,
you know,
they're
just,
right.
It's a ship.
Full
you know,
out of favour.
Just ship stuff around and it doesn't do anything particularly exciting. But there's ones where, there's one in particular which is distributes a lot of the medical stuff, and it sort of trades now at twice what the market trades at.
Wow.
And so it's those ones where you're like, well, in the end, it's still just distributing. Yes, it's distributing medicines, and so it's obviously picked up all the vaccines, but that's not that's a short term.
Won't be here next year, so to speak, or the year after.
We hope so. Yeah, it's probably two years of this massive demand, and then so pricing it off. You know, future next year's earnings, pricing it off next year's earnings, and say I'll pay 35 times next year's earnings for that. For us, it's like, okay, that's just it's a bit like all these tech stocks that have gone for a run. So you kind of say, well, no, I'll lean out of those ones and back into other ones.
Yep.
We obviously owned one of our ones we talked about for ages was Vestas Wind Energy, which is the world's largest supplier of
wind turbines,
and so that was great for us for a long time. Sold out of that recently because there's this whole tech boom, whole green tech boom, and so that went from being priced on 10 to 15 times because it's parts manufacturer. Yes, it's a very
it's a high end engineering,
high
sort
end,
of,
and they're good and everything like that. But it's sort of traded on sort of 10 to 15 times earnings, and now it's trading more like 40 times earnings.
Wow. Yep.
And so it's those ones where for us it's about saying okay. The theme came good. There's a certain price you need to pay for everything. And, and even though...
it's expensive.
Love to buy that one again, but at a lower price.
Yep, sure.
And so, earnings have not... So the price has gone up three times, but the earnings have gone up 20, 30%.
Right.
And so, it's nothing like the...
Starting to get expensive. Yeah, no, look, absolutely. That's good. Yeah, great example. All right, we'll jump across to... What have we got here? The risks.
Yes, the risks to an equities boom. So I guess to put it in. So what we're saying is we think the time's come to start switching into your and loading up on your international portfolio. We think the Aussie dollar is hasn't peaked, it's close to peaking, and so there's this, you're going to get this tailwind behind you as the Aussie dollar falls. But what are the risks to that coming true? So first is policy error. Mm-hmm. We've spoken about this being, it's not a real market. We're propped up by central banks. We're propped up by government policy.
Yep.
It seems to be the policy is headed in the right direction at the moment. There doesn't seem to be any major issues, but you start seeing some policy errors, and then that's the big issue where you can start seeing things unwind. Within Australia, I'll move on to that in a little bit, but there is higher risk of policy error that we think than what we're seeing certainly in the US.
Okay.
And so one more reason to be sort of switching out of Australia elsewhere.
Yep.
Viruses and vaccines, I guess if there's been a few issues with the AstraZeneca vaccine in particular, and various countries pausing.
Withdrawing it.
So if we start seeing that sort of wholesale issues, I think it's a low probability in our view. There's sort of about six or seven different vaccines
out
there.
There's so many out there that...
And they're all very different.
Yeah.
There's ones on the RMNA and there's all...
mRNA.
Yep. That's the one. and then there's the other ones sort of based on the coal, and there's other ones based on some stem cell technology. And so very different technologies. It's... to us, it's unlikely that all of them will all fail and all have problems.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that's a low probability, but you know, you never say never. So, yep. You know, keeping an eye on that. And we've obviously got a, with viruses, you worry about the, you always have to worry about mutations within the viruses.
Okay.
And so we've actually got this huge petri dish of the entire world, not the entire world, but, you know, a massive proportion of the world who has this disease. And that just increases the chance that you're going to see some mutation somewhere that's going to
affect the effectiveness of the current vaccine.
Vaccines. So I guess the flip side is the fact that, you know, we had six different successful vaccines developed in such a short time period says probably if there is a mutation, it'll probably be solvable.
Yep.
But
that's a good point, actually. As I said,
the risk. The bigger risk, we think. So the biggest one is policy error. The second biggest one is, I probably should have ordered these a bit differently, was the emerging markets crisis. So not a problem for now, but I think coming over the next few months will be where to watch for this. If you see a sustained boom in the US, chances are you'll then see the US dollar rising.
Yep.
If you're seeing more fiscal support in the US, you'll be seeing higher interest rates there, which will all lead to that US dollar rising. It was a sort of similar situation which caused the Asian crisis.
Okay.
And so if you saw sort of a wholesale loss of faith, I guess, within some of these countries, whether it be, you know, it might start in a country like Turkey and which we're already seeing, you know, problems with, but, you know, if it starts spreading to other countries that have US-denominated debt...
Yes, they can I was going to say. So it's more of a financial crisis as opposed to a market, sort of an external shock. It's just really from the nature of rising USD and their inability to pay.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And I guess what it is that there's a couple of different types of debt out there. We've sort of seen governments have been pretty ready to, you know, if it's people locally who can't afford to pay their mortgage, it's like, okay, we'll cancel. You don't need to pay you're going to just accrue your interest.
Yep.
If it's corporates who, you know, interest rates starting to blow out, okay, central banks are out there buying corporate debt.
Yep.
You know?
Gotcha.
That's sort of been brought back under control. And so those areas we're looking at saying, okay, well, we think if there's a crisis within those areas,
magic wand of
the
central
the rule
banks.
Book's been thrown out the air. The rule book's been thrown out the window. We've already done this stuff once.
Yep.
It'll happen again.
Sure.
The flip side is if there's an emerging markets crisis, is the central bank going to go out there and say, oh, you know, I'm worried about this emerging market crisis going right through these, I'm going to go out and buy Turkish debt to bring in the spreads? And they're like,
no,
we're not going to help. Our governments aren't going to be bailing out other people's governments, especially if there's any idea that they've been profligate. And then, you know, we even saw that within Europe last crisis. That was where, you know, you saw the Greek and the Portuguese and Italian sort of where the problems arose, you know, within the Euro countries weren't prepared to bail out other countries.
That's right.
And so if it starts to become other currencies, then that's where
all bets are off.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. So that's probably the most the most likely place you could see a problem. But you know, there's certainly no real signs. You know, Turkey's a bit of problems, but you know, one or two countries here and there, you can handle.
And that's sort of stepping now past pandemic sort of problems, isn't it? Really, just going back to the usual, you know, strong US dollar, poor emerging market sort of financial condition. So what I'm saying is it's sort of a little bit more of a reliable play, would you say? Or is it sort of, is it still both entwined?
These are very much risk cases. I guess what I'm saying is where do you... So if you want to start taking some equity, if you want to take equity exposure now, and particularly offshore equity exposure, what do you have to be watching?
Mm.
And so I'd be starting by saying policy error.
Mm-hmm.
First one you'll be watching. Second one, which is, I should have ordered these differently, is emerging markets issues.
Yep.
The third one is viruses and vaccines. And then the last of all, you know, these debt crisis issues with, okay, are central banks, and this probably partly falls under policy error, are central banks going to let corporate debt markets fail, or are they going to let, you know, we've seen... Greensill blow up recently. We've seen another big hedge fund during the week, you know, got caught out with billions of dollars of sort of $10 billion portfolio that was leveraged up sort of $50 billion,
yep.
and we saw some sort of 50% falls in Viacom and some other stocks as they were trying to unwind all their positions.
Yep.
So it's worth, I guess, that debt crisis stuff. There's a lot going on. and there's a lot of players out there with a lot of debt and very much geared. And so the issue is they can afford the interest payments because the interest payments are so low now.
Yep.
But if you start getting some big capital movements in the wrong direction, that could start unwinding some of these. We think probably there'll be bailouts and there'll be lots of central bank pressure for whether it's be banks to merge or people to take, you know, so other people to take take on some of the risks.
And that's sort of market sort of capitalism 101 though, isn't it? You know, like the zombification disappears and, you know, the quality assets can be picked up by more better prepared companies and more resource companies and things like that as well.
Yeah, I guess so I should define that a little bit. That would be capitalism 101.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't think that'll be what we'll see.
Okay.
I think we'll see more like the type of capitalism we get where the long-term capital management type one, where it's like, okay, you know, I've just grabbed all the investment banks, stuck them in a room together, and gone, there's a problem sitting over here. You guys are going to fix it.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
You guys are all taking a you caused it. You guys are all taking a hit. You all have to buy some, or some forced mergers in terms of, okay, here's a company that's got a debt problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we need to find somebody to a bigger, stronger bank to merge with.
Okay,
and yep. So I guess what I'm flagging is those. We've seen a couple of those crop up.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't seemed to be causing major issues at the moment. But you know, the more of them you see, the more concerned we need to be.
Yep.
And it's certainly a sign of the times that because it's this issue with moral hazard, where effectively we have central banks saying, no, we'll bail you out. You know,
no matter what.
No matter what.
Be as egregious as you like. Take as big a swings as you like.
And so. You know there's going to be hedge funds out there who will be as egregious as they can and take some big swings. With the view that for some of those, you know, they started with, you spoke about that one, a $10 billion fund with $50 billion worth of actual exposures.
Yep.
So if it goes up 10%, so 50 goes to 55, the fund itself's only worth 10, so it's gone 10 to 15. That's a 50% return.
Yeah,
so
10, that's right.
Yeah,
yep.
five times the leverage on the way up.
Yep.
And if it goes the wrong way, so it's gone down 20%, and
wiped it out. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And so, whereas they had it gone up 20%, they doubled their money, and
you won't be reading about it in the papers.
No, and partly, you know, chances are as well, they probably did double a few times. They probably and the partners all took home, you know,
big bucks and
$10-20 million bonuses.
Yep.
And then you keep going double again. Oh no, the whole thing blew up. Oh, that's all right. I've parked away $50-100 million on the last few times I did it. I started with a billion, and you know, I've doubled my money 10 times up to 10 billion, and then I blow the whole thing up.
Yep.
And so that won't be the last. There'll be plenty of other ones out there with similar types of structures. You think, I think though, now's the time to be watching out for them, because we've seen the issues with GameStop, and we ran through a podcast of that a couple of weeks ago.
Yep.
It was exactly the themes I was talking about in that GameStop one, is that the hedge funds rely on prime brokers, and the prime brokers are now having a closer, because of GameStop, are now having a closer look at their
risk management. Yep.
And starting to say, okay, well, maybe this isn't all right.
Mm.
And so I think that's where, I don't know whether this latest one's related to that, but, you know, I think you'll see more and more of those ones where behavior that might have been, look, we're a little bit outside our limits, okay, just make sure you get them back in within the next month or so, turns into we're a little bit outside our limits, bad luck, you're selling that right now.
Yeah.
We are trading this stock today. And then that gets traded and it takes a big discount, and then all of a sudden, okay, if that, we've just lost money on that trade deal, which now means the next one's actually going to fall. Now we have to sell the next one, and then the next one, the next thing you know, you've liquidated half your portfolio. And
yep.
Yeah,
interesting. Okay,
so
very good.
So that's your big risks at the moment.
We've got a question that's just dropped in as well, and welcome any other questions from our viewers listening in. I'm not sure if now's the time to cover off on this one, but
uranium stocks.
Yeah, the question is now the time for uranium mining stocks looking long-term? Uranium, Damien.
Look, on my numbers, and I've run this past. We ran we had a Ross Garneau in a couple of weeks ago, and spoke about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've run some ones on the whole solar power thing probably about a year ago. Is that uranium doesn't look very low cost at all, and so it's very much a
So this is just not just the mining, but the usage and the and the removal.
Exactly. Yep. So the actual production of energy with that, and the costs haven't come down considerably. Mm-hmm. And so it looks like one of the highest cost ways. And now solar is way under it, and even solar plus batteries is not that far above uranium. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to, as solar plus batteries comes down, that's going to hit the level. And so, you know, I'd say for most people, if the question was, would you like to have a solar farm plus a bunch of batteries, you know, pop up next door to your place, Tim?
Yep.
Or would you like a small nuclear reactor? And we promise we fix them, and then there's not going to be any problems anymore.
Yeah, yep.
Which would you like?
Not an easy sell, is it, to the electorate, I guess, in a way.
Yeah. And look, they well might be right that they've fixed the problems and you won't, you know, and that you know, all the issues we had with things like Fukushima Mile Island and...
I might just devil's advocate that, though, because solar's just a lay-down misere in Australia. You know, we can put solar panels on the whole of Australia and probably, you know, power the entire country, if we wanted to, with a bit of transmission loss. A little bit harder in... We use, obviously, a good example, or maybe a poor example, is Japan. You know, land constricted, solar not as relevant, or if not impossible.
Yep.
And so uranium, and I'm sure there's a whole host of other countries that are in a similar boat. Is that potentially where there's some upside for uranium? Or do we just ship off solar through under an undersea channel pipe or something from somewhere vis-a-vis Mr. Cannon Brooks to Singapore?
Look, my take is that within Australia, we have some of the highest electricity costs in the world, despite being the biggest exporter in the world of gas and coal. Mm-hmm. So we've got the most resources, but because of policy errors, we've ended up with some of the highest electricity prices in the world, which actually means that solar is profitable or is worthwhile endeavor for most people. And solar plus batteries, we've got these lines coming down, and we think it's not far away. The US is different. The US, you're probably paying at least half was the Australian price.
Yep.
And so you're a lot further away from getting to that stage. Mm. Japan, I think, is about sort of maybe 10-20% cheaper than Australia. Mm-hmm. So you're not far off those same economics. So I guess what I keep looking at those economics and the price falling year after year. If you made the assumption that prices are going to stay where they are today, solar prices aren't going to get any cheaper, batteries aren't going to get any cheaper, then uranium has a good future.
Okay.
Within places like Japan or even places like the UK. Mm-hmm. If you make the assumption, though, that technology is going to keep getting better, mm-hmm. as we make more and more solar panels, it's going to get cheaper, mm-hmm. Which I think are pretty reasonable assumptions to make, then all of a sudden uranium just does not look as positive.
Out of the water.
There are some short-term, there's potential short-term wins for uranium. Mm-hmm. The prices for uranium are very cheap at the moment and not profitable for people to be mining. Mm-hmm. So there's some short-term... Okay, maybe prices will need to go up in order to encourage somebody to make a new mine just to run the existing ones.
Yep.
But that's a trade. It's not a. You're basically saying I'm going to invest in a sector which is underspent on capex, mm-hmm. with a view that I'm going to stay there until somebody announces yes, I'm building a big mine somewhere. And once that announcement comes, you need to be piling out and getting back somewhere else.
Okay.
But and the other factor with uranium is there's a lot of political issues with it in terms of saying
who's going to look after it at the other end.
Yeah, well, there's that side, but there's also the part about there's a rise in China, mm-hmm. and so militarily, issues about Taiwan and Hong Kong is saying the US, for example, wants to make sure it's got a reasonable supply. Mm-hmm. Russia wants to make sure it's got a reasonable supply. You've got China, UK, France, anyone who's got nuclear power wants to make sure they've got. Nuclear weapons wants to make sure they've got a reasonable supply of it.
Yep.
If it means subsidising mines or that mines are producing at
optimal levels or profitable levels.
Yep. Then that may well happen.
Yeah,
so I guess I don't want to say you're not going to make money from it. I guess what I'm saying is I think there's...
it's a narrowing gap of opportunity.
Yeah, and they're subject to political whims and things like that. So
okay. Now, we've got a chart up here as well. We might need to take a couple of moments to just quickly run through this one.
So
I put it up a little bit early. Sorry, I went to that question. And thank you, Lily, for that question. Yeah, if you want to step us through this one. Yeah, it's a heat map, is it?
Yeah, this is just a heat map of the returns over the last year by the type of by the quantitative factors, and it's for the US S&P. It's pretty similar to a lot of the other markets, but you know, using this one just because it's one of the bigger markets. And the key bit is this whole valuation tag, and so you can see it's very green at the top of the valuation, and so value has actually been a really bad performer for the last couple of years.
Okay.
This latest month in particular was a real boom month for value, so we had positioned our portfolio very much for that. And it's worth noting, though, that when you get such a huge move all in one month, chances of reversals are high.
It's run pretty hard. Yep.
Having said that, you know, we still think there is a bit within the value factor. It just you might not get it straight away.
Yep. Okay.
It's important to be quite discerning. There are some of the worst stocks have run the hardest. Again, it's just that the same factor I was talking about before, where the worst mining stocks are the ones that run the hardest when prices
when
rise.
Come back. Yep.
Some of the stocks that have risen the most have been the ones that were like, hey, this thing's about to fall over, or it's got too much debt and it might not make it.
Yep.
To like, oh, they're going to survive, great.
Yeah,
and up goes, you sort of get half the rallies. Hey, these guys aren't going
to
go broke.
Turn to mean.
And then the other half is actual. Oh, value stocks are going well.
Yeah, sure.
And okay. So I'd be quite discerning about what you're going to buy within that, unless, I guess our view is that the inflation shock, shouldn't be treated as this is going to go on forever.
Mm.
This should be there's a blip, there's a likely return to the prior trend. Looking at the risk factors from that, rather than saying, it's all changed, everything's good to go from here.
Okay. Yeah, very good.
And at the other end, some of the momentum type factors are the real ones which have suffered, and growth factors as well. So growth factors haven't been good. Momentum factors. Now, momentum factors are the ones where people, basically traders, getting in there and saying, okay, so if the stock's gone up in the last year, I'm going to just assume it's going to keep going up.
Okay.
And that's been subject. We've had volatile markets. If you're sort of trend follower, it's been a tough few months, and we're expecting that to continue in terms of it's not something we want to do within ours, because we're trying to limit the turnover with the portfolio, but it's going to be a tough one going for the next few months, because we think there's enough volatility around and enough concern about which way things are going to move.
Okay, so potentially the death of value. I've heard it many times.
Well, value's back now.
Yeah, it's back.
But will it last? Yeah, we think there's a couple of months. There's probably. But after such a strong month,
The
question is, will there be a bit of a reversal next month? Quite possibly you get a bit of reversals in the short term. I think there's a bit more to run in it.
Yep.
But you want it, this whole amphetamines recovery has condensed everything.
Yep.
So now's the time to be thinking about when do we start getting out of value, and we're sort of rotating through some of our value stocks that have run up.
Okay.
To look for other ones.
Okay, sure thing. Mm. We'll jump across to this is our
Yeah,
our
just
portfolio.
Looking at some of our yeah. Sorry, just looking at some of the weights which we're looking at. Just highlighting which are some of the sectors, and so that idea that material sector through the cement stuff was one of the big parts. That's a very classic value play. There's another few within that, and so we've been winding back on a couple of those ones and upping a few within other sectors. Say the IT sector, there's a few which we've sort of been picking up just because they've been hit, and so a couple more quality stocks we like that sort of adding some to. Within the finance sector, not wanting to be too far behind in terms of that, and defensives, we're very much underweight. That's the whole defensives, the whole defensive side. And the manufacturing, so that we're still looking at cyclicals and just trying to rotate through the cyclicals and which are the ones that have run up and which are the ones that we still think have got further to run.
Yep. Okay, wonderful.
What else was it? Oh, currency is very important right now. Actually, let's move into currency the next few slides, because I know we've been probably running a bit longer than I thought.
Yep, no
fiscal
problems.
Guns. So I just wanted to do a quick comparison between the major areas of the market. So I've called it the fiscal guns loaded. So we've got the US very clearly spending a lot more money than anyone else.
Mm.
And
as usual.
Yeah. Well, but I've got to say as well that it's particularly well targeted. Like it's like if you went through a list of productivity measures that you would like to see within the US, you'd go, okay, roads and bridges and all these things are behind. They need to catch up. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can get some stuff, some more into the education system, particularly early year education system.
Yep.
And it's just as you go through the Biden's list of things, it's like tick the box, tick the box, tick the box. So,
yeah, right.
Which is different to Australia, which is sort of, I'm comparing the next one,
yep.
where a lot of it's all about saying, oh, we need to spend money on CapEx. And you're like, well, just a minute, we've already got... you know, we've already have this capacity. We need to, get companies spending it on money on CapEx. And we're like, well, we've already got the capacity, lots of capacity.
Yep.
People
are going to build another factory. Yeah, this one's not,
yeah. Cool.
Yep.
And so, and the other thing I want to highlight is Australia's made some quite big announcements, but there's not a lot of follow-through in terms of, the follow-through, the actual policies haven't been encouraging of it. So the one that came out last year was, you know, all these loans to businesses. Mm. There's going to be $40 billion worth of loans to businesses, and less than 5% of that was actually made.
Yep.
Because the structure of it was that the banks weren't incentivized to do it.
Yep, that's right.
We had another one come out, Job Maker, I think they called it, which was going to be this massive, we're going to hire thousands and thousands of people, $200 a week.
That's right.
Going to be giving to everyone
subsidized
to do
it. Under 30 or whatever it was. Yeah.
So
the workforce.
Yep. When you read through the fine print, people need to have been on Job Seeker for, I think it's 28 days or something. There's quite a long period, so
yep.
it's the type of thing where
a little bit complicated.
Yeah, and you know, okay, I need to hire whatever, a new accountant or a new builder or a new whatever, and if they haven't been on that thing,
yeah,
and getting those, you know, the actually getting it looks like it's going to be come through with a. Again, it'll be a 5% of what was called out.
Yep.
A lot of the CapEx stuff is all about it's actually just a bring forward of some of the – so what effectively happens is accelerated depreciation. So instead of getting your tax benefit over
5 or 10 years.
Yeah, yep. So spend $1 million rather than getting $200,000 a year in tax benefit. I actually get to take it all in the upfront first year.
Yep.
But which means you pay it off in the next – you pay more tax in the next few years. So not that's not a positive thing or whatever, but it's not a there's this announcement of we've given away this massive, you know, this massive amount of money, and it's like, well, no, you haven't. You've just changed where it's been
received.
And so I think Australia's got some very big numbers that they're saying, and when you do as a percentage of GDP is spending all this money on fiscal support, whereas when you actually dig into what's going on, they start to look worse and a lot worse, yep. and targeted in the wrong area.
Yeah, sure.
And so all the parts where you're like, okay, we want to get the people on the lowest salaries, we want to get more and more benefits to them, which is what we're seeing in the US, so because they'll get out and spend the money. In Australia, we're taking away the benefits and trying to give away tax cuts to the richer people.
Yep.
So So I guess that's US is clear. Australia's is murky.
Yep.
At best.
Okay.
Europe. Continually seem to be behind the curve, so they're spending more, but it's very reluctant. I wouldn't say reluctant, but it's very measured. Whereas the US is like, okay, no, we've got a chance. Biden's basically they've seen this before, where Republicans say no, we don't want to spend enough money, and they get a weak recovery from the last time when Obama was in power. This time they're like, okay, we have enough votes to get this through. We're going to ram through as much as possible to get this whole thing going. It's going big.
Yep.
Go big while we can.
Yep.
Europe seems to be, we'll do a little bit now, and if things don't work out, we'll do a little bit more, and then we'll do a little bit more and a little bit more, which...
There's a bit of death by committee with Europe, though, isn't it? Like, this quagmire of countries in one currency, and it just, you can see where they'd be hamstrung from pillar to post every day of the week.
Yes, and they're certainly struggling with the vaccine rollout in a lot of countries as well. So Europe's not looking particularly particularly strong. Japan just seems to be more of, you know, for years they've been trying to work out how to spend more money and haven't been able to do it. So
central bank's been trying to figure out how to buy more stock on the stock market.
Yeah. So I guess as you're looking through them, it's pretty clear the US is going to be is definitely the leader on that front, which means they're probably going to have stronger growth and higher inflation and higher interest rates, which leads to that higher US dollar, lower in other currencies.
Yep. Okay.
Then you flip to the next side, which is the monetary side. So yeah. On this side, I think it's the US seems to be sort of doing the least in terms of the question about will they do yield curve control, and the answer's been no. It seems as if markets are going to try and push the Fed to the point where saying, well, are you going to do it? And we keep pushing rates higher until you finally come out and start saying,
Controlling them. Yeah.
Yeah. So, so there are some risks in terms of, you know, do interest rates get too high over there that you start seeing some of the areas slow down. So I think already home building is one area which the amount of loans that are being refinanced has dropped off.
Okay.
So so certainly something to watch there. We think the fiscal side is big enough, and we think the monetary, we think the will is there, but it's, will there be some short-term indigestion? There might be.
Mm-hmm.
Australia is the flip side. So Australia, we were talking before about the fiscal side, you know, these big announcements that don't have a lot of substance behind them and are probably pointed in the wrong direction. On the monetary side, the Australian, as we spoke with Ross, you know, a few weeks ago on this podcast, the Australian Central Bank has been very much behind the curve and fighting last year's war and behind everyone. They seem to have taken a pretty big jump,
yep.
and now are actually sort of more towards the forefront.
Yep. Okay.
So it's quite possible that you'll see the Australian Central Bank doing more. And so it's this part where, you know, from a currency perspective, if you have the Australian Central Bank doing lots, basically trying to get the Aussie dollar down, the US Central Bank sort of letting things go a little bit.
Yep.
So that sort of says US dollar up. On the fiscal side, US doing all the right things, trying to get productivity going and pushing through lots and lots of fiscal stimulus. The Australian one making lots of announcements, but actually not a lot of follow through. It all points to a higher US dollar.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
In the medium term.
Yep.
On the central banking side, the European Central Bank seems to be following the Japanese Central Bank, which is just keep doing more and keep putting in more programs and just chasing those rates down to zero and below.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best hope for Europe is success in the US that then sort of prompts them to follow suit.
Yeah, sure.
But at the moment, I think it's a bit more of the same in terms of Europe and Japan.
Mm.
So, from a central bank perspective, it's pointing, you know, if we want exposure, we want to try and get offshore exposure. We want to try and get exposure to the US.
Yep.
Having said that, you can get some cheaper stocks in Europe that have US exposure. So that's been one area we've been trying to play in as much as we can. But getting some US exposure is pretty key,
the key
to portfolios at the moment.
So just quickly on the dollar itself, on the AUD, so you're calling it as a bit of a temporary or interim high, do you think? Or is it sort of starting to go back into falling AUD zone again?
Look, I think over the medium term it's falling AUD zone. Look,
yep.
Will there be some short-term issues that might push it higher? Possibly.
Mm.
We spoke about the whole commodities cycle last time and how we were saying, look, there's a super cycle in prices, but there's not a super cycle in volumes,
mm-hmm.
which says that the volumes come back on as pandemic things lift and the prices will come back. That's going to be pushing the Aussie dollar down. So, as a medium term, it's worth accumulating international now. Maybe there's another 5% upside or something like that in the Aussie dollar. If a few events all line up together, maybe Brazil has more problems with having a few more, they're having a lot of deaths in younger people in COVID deaths. So maybe that turns into production losses in some of the Brazilian mines, which then pushes iron ore up higher.
Yep.
Who knows? But I guess the net effect is, as a medium-term view, it's time to be accumulating those international assets.
Yep.
And if the Aussie dollar goes higher, we'll just be accumulating more of them.
Yeah, sure. Okay. No, very good. And we'll zoom back around to the investment outlook and
I think probably the whole thing's been an investment outlook. We probably won't skip that now unless there's any other questions you want to...
You're pretty good for questions at the moment. No, that's fine. But probably just finally, just one from me was... obviously we've spoken a lot about overseas, but just to pay a little bit of attention to some of the Aussie stimulus roll-off, and obviously we've seen JobKeeper roll-off this month, or at least the majority of it.
Yesterday.
Happy Easter. The business cash flow boosts and things like that. Thoughts on the Aussie side? Obviously, we sort of kicked off in my little blurb that it's probably not presenting the the most exciting or stimulatory environment on that front. Is that sort of a similar sort of vein, I think, for Aussie going forward? Do you think there's going to be a period of a few months where the Aussie market sort of, or Aussie investment managers perhaps sort of go, okay, I'm just going to sit tight for a minute
we're certainly reaching a higher risk point. It's probable that there's enough growth now and there's enough savings, and as people start to deploy their savings.
Yep.
I think if the vaccine rollout keeps getting stuffed up, that's possibly a headwind. But I think for the moment, we're taking the view that there's probably enough momentum to push through the pain we're going to have from the removal of these, and people are starting to have to pay their mortgage again, and there'll probably be some not quite forced selling by people in terms of properties, but there'll be certainly more properties on the market for people who are in financial distress than what there was over the last year.
We've got a pretty white hot property market at the moment as well, which is probably helping that, isn't it? Rather than being the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if the property price is up 10%, then okay, they can sell, they can cash somebody out and say, great, here you go. You know what, Tim? Yeah, I forced you to sell your house, but here's 50 grand to.
That's right. You got a bit of breathing room
to get going versus selling you out and saying, thanks, Tim.
You owe me 50 grand.
Yeah, exactly. I've sold your house and you owe.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
So I think there's enough momentum, but the risk is high. The risk is more elevated than it's been over the last 6 months.
Okay.
And so, that's what we're paying quite close attention to is short term measures within Australia. Mm-hmm. We're paying quite close attention to inflation and how sustainable inflation is going to be.
Yep.
And then policy error. So there are three big things we're trying to keep an eye on. In terms of saying, okay, if we've got it wrong, that's where we're going to see the signs within some of those.
Wonderful. All right, very good. Well, look, thanks for your time today, Damien. Looking forward to March's performance report as well after a terrific month. And we'll jump across to our question of the week. So do you think local or global equities will see more growth in or throughout 2021? Feel free to drop in your comments in the YouTube chat. And we always look forward to reading those and reflecting on those as well. Thanks to all of those who have watched in live for another great episode. Lily, of course, who asked a question today. I hope you've taken away some great ideas, and if you haven't already, feel free to click like on the video to give us some feedback. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content to stay up to date on news from us. Follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who get something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. Thanks again for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and the team, and we look forward to catching you with the next one. Cheers.